Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kathy Kelly of the group Voices in the Wilderness, who explains why she and other activists have undertaken a fast in front of the United Nations to protest the White House plans for war against Iraq and the devastating effects of economic sanctions. Jason Hagen of the Washington Office on Latin America, who assesses the hardline policies of Colombia's new right-wing president, Alvaro Uribe. And Mark Berenson, father of Lori Berenson, who is serving 20 years in a Peruvian prison, discusses the Inter-American Human Rights Court's ruling that Berenson was denied due process in both her military and civil trials. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The bloody conflict in Sudan is often characterized by Westerners as a religious war, fundamentalist Islam versus Christians. However, the war is also a battle over natural resources, as corporations try to exploit southern Sudan's oil and water reserves. 3 years ago, an oil pipeline opened from the oil-rich Nuba region to the Red Sea. Currently, companies from China, Malaysia, Sweden, Canada, Italy, France, and Qatar are prospecting for oil in the Sudan. But critics have blasted oil companies for acting hand-in-hand with the army in ethnic cleansing operations in southern Sudan. According to a Canadian government report, the Sudanese army initiated a major attack on villages just 2 days after the Talisman Energy Company requested assistance in a cleanup operation near its oil drilling sites. The attack by helicopters resulted in driving out or killing half of the local population. Now, many of the villagers from the oil-rich region live in refugee camps near the capital city of Khartoum, where they are tightly controlled by security forces. With the sinking stock market and new spending on the war on terrorism, the U.S. government is now running a $165 billion deficit. But things are worse than they first appear. According to Citizens for Tax Justice, a progressive think tank, the Bush administration has engineered some gimmicks to hide the full scale of the budget hole. For example, the administration shifted $23 billion in corporate tax payments from last year's surplus, making the real deficit $188 billion. And once again, the American government is dipping into the Social Security Trust Fund. According to Citizens for Tax Justice, much of the blame for the new budget deficit goes to the Bush 10-year tax cut that gave over half of the benefits to citizens making over $1 million a year. Meanwhile, most middle-class taxpayers have already seen the bulk of their tax relief in the decade-long tax cut. But the benefits are just starting to roll in for the top 1% of tax filers. By 2010, families making over $1 million a year in income will receive an average tax break of $1.5 million. The Bush tax cuts, including the elimination of the estate tax, will inflict more pain on already fiscally squeezed state governments. In the last few months, 15 states and Washington, D.C. have opted out of Bush's regressive tax cuts in order to protect future revenue. So far, only three states, Florida, Maine, and West Virginia, have voted to adopt the Bush tax formula on estate and corporate taxes. Mother Jones Magazine reports that while a half a million American adults sit behind bars for breaking drug laws, there is little thought by government authorities to the children left behind. In a recent report, Human Rights Watch, looking at data from New York State, estimated that 24,000 children had one parent in jail for violating the harsh Rockefeller drug laws. And since 1980, nearly 125,000 children in New York State alone had at least one parent do time on drug charges. A similar report, commissioned by the California State Assembly 2 years ago, found that over 850,000 minors, or 9% of all children, had one parent currently involved in the state's criminal justice system. Still, Human Rights Watch openly admits that it does not know the full scope of the crisis because there is little data collected about the disruption of children's lives when a parent goes to jail. Gwynne Bird, a consultant hired by the California State Legislature, noted, "We only think about the punishment side of things. We don't think about the ripple effect that it might have on other people when somebody gets arrested and incarcerated." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Bush administration's plan to wage war against Iraq has run into opposition from some unexpected quarters in recent weeks. While Democrats have largely muted their criticism of the Bush march to war, several prominent officials of past Republican administrations and GOP legislators have publicly cautioned that a unilateral attack on Iraq by the U.S. could create greater instability in the Middle East and harm long-term American interests. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor to the first President Bush, U.S. Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, and House Majority Leader Dick Armey have warned that the White House has not yet made a convincing case to the American people that an attack on Iraq now is justified and has not prepared adequately for the consequences of such a war. Adding to renewed debate on U.S. policy toward Iraq are news reports that officials of the Reagan administration provided critical battle planning assistance to Saddam Hussein in his war with Iran during the 1980s, even as Baghdad's use of chemical weapons during that conflict were universally condemned. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator with Voices in the Wilderness, a group which has long opposed United Nations U.S. sanctions against Iraq. Kelly, who has visited Iraq 15 times, explains why she and seven other activists undertook a symbolic 40-day fast beginning August 3rd in front of the United Nations headquarters in New York City.
We feel that fasting is a way to remind ourselves that, you know, it's very difficult for people in other parts of the world, particularly we're focused on Iraq, not to have choices about what they eat. But to be relegated to eating inadequate diets and giving those inadequate diets and poisoned water to their children in many, many cases all across Iraq. And so it's a good discipline just for us to break away from what's normal in our lives, to be filled really with comforts and convenience and try to bring to mind and bring into our own lives a situation that's pretty abnormal really, but given the readiness of our country to wage constant and relentless warfare, economic and military, against Iraqi civilians, we think we should break with what seems to be normal. It's not normal to be using the United Nations as an instrument of warfare against children. It's not normal to have child slaughter and child sacrifice on our hands to the point of over 500,000 children under age 5 having died because of these policies.
You mentioned you were hoping that average citizens and elected officials and policymakers would break ranks with the current United States, United Nations policy of sanctions against Iraq and certainly the talk of war that's in the air. Surprisingly, we've heard from Dick Armey, Brent Scowcroft, Henry Kissinger, all questioning the current policy. But what can you tell us about this apparent split among particularly Republicans at this point? Democrats seem to remain silent.
Well, I hope that when people, for instance, hear Senator Hagel saying containment is working just fine, that they won't accept that as an alternative to warfare. I mean, that's what certainly happened in 1990. People said sanctions will work just fine. And containment is, I think, a code word for sanctions. It does seem that President Bush may have gone so far out on a limb, kind of pushed out there, I think, by the most right-wing hawkish members of his administration, that some other voices, including voices that were quite close to his father, like Mr. Scowcroft, were needed to go public in order to give a chance to pull things back. And I would guess that some of the people very concerned about the U.S. ability to recycle petrodollars from the Middle East back into U.S. banks, back into U.S. defense companies, don't like it one bit that an attack against Iraq could possibly create so much chaos and upheaval in the event of a civil war or in the event of an invasion of Iraq from the south or in the event that a new government would be placed in and then would be toppled in the event that the Saudis would be so angry they might tell the United States to take a hike, that it's quite possible that the people who keep their eye on the ball being oil and oil prices and oil stability and oil revenue getting recycled back into the U.S., maybe saying, hey, stop, wait a minute. We don't want to take this step until we're perfect sure that we can impose in Iraq a regime that will be in control and very much working to serve United States interests.
How do you respond to people who say that Saddam Hussein represents a threat to its neighbors and the United States, that weapons of mass destruction certainly could be unleashed on innocents around the region or even the United States. And maybe you could weave into that some of the latest revelations in the New York Times about how the United States continued to aid Iraq in its war against Iran at a time when Iraq was using these chemical weapons.
Well, it certainly is clear that there's a terrific hypocrisy going on, that people who worked for the Reagan administration, including Mr. Rumsfeld and Secretary of State Powell, knew and were not at all speaking out against the advice of Defense Intelligence Agency experts given to Iraq about when and where to use nerve gas against the Iranians, and that on the very day when chemical weapons are alleged to have been used against the Kurds in Halabja by the Iraqi government, Donald Rumsfeld was in Iraq. He was carrying a handwritten letter from President Reagan. He was seeking to shore up the Iraqi government because they didn't want Iraq to lose to Iran at that point. What then did Mr. Rumsfeld have to say about weapons of mass destruction, about chemical weaponry in Iraq? Not one word. I want to say that I don't believe that Iraq is a threat to its immediate neighbors. I mean, how is Iraq a threat to Turkey when Turkey invades northern Iraq quite regularly to go in and attack Kurds? Is Iraq a threat to Kuwait or a threat to Saudi Arabia when both of those countries are backed up by the U.S. military? Is Iraq a threat to Iran when Iran, in fact, can deliver ballistic missiles as far as Tel Aviv? I doubt it. Is Iraq a threat right now to Egypt when Egypt is one of the top recipients of military aid, and the Egyptian people are in the streets begging that sanctions be lifted and that there be no new warfare against Iraq? Is Iraq a threat to Israel? I think in its belligerent rhetoric, the answer is yes, that Iraq has made statements about the desirability of seeing Israel ruined, harmed. I myself will never approve of any country or any leader wishing harm on a civilian population elsewhere or wanting to eliminate another country. That's unacceptable. But I believe it's mainly rhetoric. Israel has 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons. Is Iraq a threat to the United States? I think the most honest answer to that question is that Iraq poses a threat to the U.S. ability to control Iraq's oil, full stop. Now, is that a reason for us to go to war, or would we not in this country be much better off if we had an energy policy and we didn't consume and guzzle so much of the world's resources? Wouldn't we be better off if we'd learn to live without the expectation that we can automatically take as much as we want and automatically be people who already have so much and are somehow entitled to get more? Is that good for us? I don't think so.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator with Voices in the Wilderness. The group can be contacted by calling area code 773-784-8065 or visit their website at www.vitw.org. As Colombia's new hardline president, Alvaro Uribe, was sworn into office on August 7th, the nation's largest guerrilla group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, launched a mortar attack against the presidential palace near the parliament building where the inauguration was underway. 19 people were killed, mostly residents of Bogota's poorest neighborhood. Less than a week later, Uribe declared a state of emergency, restricting civil liberties and imposing a new tax to finance the recruitment and training of 100,000 new soldiers and police. Over the past 2 years, the U.S. has provided the Colombian government with more than $1.7 billion to fight the nation's four-decade-long civil war. Earlier this year, Congress acceded to a Bush administration request to lift restrictions limiting U.S. aid to counter-narcotics operations. Now, American weapons and Pentagon-trained troops can be deployed directly against guerrilla groups. In the coming year, Washington plans to allocate $98 million to create a special battalion under U.S. command to protect a Colombian pipeline owned by the U.S.-based Occidental Oil Company. Between the lines, Scott Harris reached Jason Hagen of the Washington Office on Latin America in Bogota, where he was winding up a fact-finding mission. Hagen discusses the dangers he sees in the pursuit of a military solution to the conflict sought by both President Uribe and his supporters in Washington.
Well, I think to understand the rise of Álvaro Uribe, you have to understand the role or the nature of the conflict in this country. For 3.5 years, the government of Colombia had what we could call peace negotiations with the largest guerrilla group, the FARC, and that's an 18,000-member guerrilla insurgency in this country. And for 3.5 years, those peace discussions were conducted, and they didn't really go very far. And they finally ended on February 20th of this year. And at that time, the presidential campaign was in full swing. And Álvaro Uribe had a very hardline stance. He does not trust the FARC, the guerrillas. And he basically said that Colombia needs to escalate the war against the guerrillas instead of conducting peace dialogue. And because his rhetoric in the campaign coincided with the end of the peace talks, he did very well in the campaign, and he won the election quite easily. Basically, the reason people voted for him was because he promises to crack down on the guerrillas and really put an end to this conflict in Colombia, which has been going on for 40 years and some say even 100 years.
He came into office with much talk, particularly in the human rights community, that he had ties to the paramilitary death squads and that there was a lot of concern and fear that his policies would not only be a hard line toward the guerrilla groups, but would countenance and protect the death squads and those elements of the military that were regularly committing human rights abuses against civilians.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of accusations that not only had he been linked to drug traffickers, but also to paramilitaries. And none of those accusations have been able to stick very well. Irrespective of his past, if you look at his current policies and the things that he's talking about today, they are quite alarming. First and foremost, I think this idea of creating a million-person militia. He wants to directly invite the civilian population to participate in the conflict. And he wants a million Colombians to act as spies, essentially, to work with the police and the military throughout the country and to provide information on suspicious activities. On the surface, that may not sound all that bad, because given the nature of the conflict in Colombia, they really do need greater citizen participation. But if you look at it in practice and given the nature of the Colombian conflict, it's very, very alarming, because given this decades-old conflict, you have a history of private retribution and personal vendettas, and you also have this very frightening growth of the paramilitaries. Since 1996, you had the paramilitaries, which were created as a response to the guerrilla insurgency, and they were created by wealthy Colombians who lacked confidence in the legal judicial system and in the police and the military to protect their interests. And they have been bankrolling the paramilitaries, and the paramilitaries also benefit from the drug trade. And now they count about 15,000 members. They've tripled in size in only a few years, and they are increasingly targeting the civilian population and getting involved much more deeply in this conflict. And by creating this million-person militia, it's very probable that these paramilitaries will play a very prominent role in this militia. In Colombia, the situation has become polarized in many ways, and typically the right wing and, for example, this new government, has depicted human rights groups as somehow enemies of the Colombian state and somehow enemies of the Colombian people, and they oftentimes get lumped with the guerrillas and with terrorists. And I've spoken to several organizations who have said that they have received personal threats. Some of them are very concerned that they won't be able to stay here for the 4 years. Some of them have already had their offices raided. And it's very alarming.
Could this conflict get out of hand incrementally? Could Congress step by step increase our involvement in Colombia to the point where we are looking at a major U.S. commitment of troops?
I think most people in Washington believe that they can maybe resolve this by signing checks. But my concern, and I don't think I'm alone on this, is that there is this possibility of incrementalism. Right now, Washington is satisfied with writing checks, $500 million, $700 million, maybe a billion. But at some point, when your investment becomes so large, sending troops becomes a logical step to take. I don't think either government has been very honest about the type of financial commitment it will take to win this war militarily. I think right now Bogota has been telling Washington one thing, and Washington for some reason has believed Bogota that with $500 million or $700 million a year, you can resolve this militarily. I don't think that's even close. I think that it's going to require billions and billions of dollars for many years to win this militarily. Clearly, Bogota right at this point does not have the money to do that, and Washington is not ready to make that type of commitment. So my concern is that you have this escalated stalemate, a deepening quagmire, in which case nothing is resolved. You have an intensifying conflict and more money flowing into the country, and it's not changing the correlation of forces. It's not changing the hands of any of the parties involved. And so maybe 4 years from now, 8 years from now, maybe they'll be ready to talk peace, and it won't be any different than it looks now.
That was Jason Hagen of the Washington Office on Latin America. Contact the group by calling area code 202-797-2171 or visit their website at www.wola.org. In 1995, Lori Berenson, a U.S. citizen living in Peru, was arrested, convicted of treason, and sentenced to life in prison for her alleged collaboration with the leftist Tupac Amaru guerrilla group. After Peru's highest military court overturned Berenson's original conviction and nullified her sentence, she was accorded a civilian trial in 2001 that found her guilty of collaborating with terrorists. This charge carried a sentence of 20 years in prison and a fine of $28 million U.S. dollars in civil damages. But the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights recently ruled that neither Berenson's military or civilian trial provided due process, and that the terrorism laws under which she was tried twice and imprisoned for nearly 7 years were illegal. Peru has since challenged the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights ruling in favor of Berenson by suing the commission in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. After the Peruvian Supreme Court denied Berenson's appeal in February of this year, her only hope for release would be a presidential pardon, which would be unpopular amongst Peru's high officials. Peruvian President Alejandro Toledo has thus far refused to grant a pardon. Mark Berenson is the father of Lori Berenson. He spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari about his hopes that the Inter-American Court of Human Rights decision will assist in securing his daughter's freedom.
The problem with Toledo is he's just not lived up to anyone's promises. He's been very wishy-washy. He doesn't stick to anything. He's considered a liar. He met with my wife and I right after Lori was sentenced back in June and thought that the Inter-American Human Rights Commission would be a place that he would like to see what they say about Lori's case as a way of resolving the issue. Then when President Bush approached him again in June or July of 2001, about Lori, he again agreed with President Bush that the Inter-American Human Rights Commission was a way in which he would have a chance to examine the case totally and see what conclusions could be reached, whether there could be some sort of humanitarian or regular resolution to the case. Well, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission last month made their decision that Lori's civilian trial last year was a joke, a total sham. It did not meet international standards of fairness and due process. And now Lori has been tried twice in Peru over almost a seven-year period, once by a military court and once by a civilian court, that failed to adequately meet her rights according to the American Convention of Human Rights, to which Peru is a signatory, and has failed to live up to its international obligations to change these terrorism laws that were put in by the former president, the dictator Fujimori, now hiding in Japan, avoiding extradition for murder and human rights abuses, etc. Peru, just by not adhering to the current decision of the commission against Lori, not only is Toledo reneging on his promise, but that Peru is defending what Fujimori, the dictator, did for all those years in which he locked innocent people up as a way of combating political opposition rather than caring as much for his so-called war against terrorism.
There has also been a dismissal of two of the civil trial judges as well. On July 19th, it was announced by the National Council of Magistrates, the independent juridical body in Peru that appoints judges, that it dismissed Judge Marcos Isabeta of the Anti-Terrorism Court and Judge Ileana Araujo Sanchez. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Mark?
Yes. Lori was tried by three judges. There was no jury. The civilian trial had three judges, the two you named, plus a temporary non-tenured judge, and also by two prosecutors. And the five worked hand in hand. Congressman at the time, Joe Scarborough, a Republican of Florida, visited the court trial and said that this isn't a fair trial. These five people are all working together against Lori. The deck is stacked. And he was a lawyer who spoke Spanish, and he was down there, and he saw part of that trial. Since Lori's trial ended in June of 2001, both prosecutors have been fired by this Council of Magistrates, and now two of the three judges, leaving only the untenured judge who's still existing and practicing as a judge in Peru, and that's and the reason he's still around is his record hasn't come before this Council of Magistrates. He's going to be canned also.
Mark Berenson, do you want to make a correlation, if there is one, or your opinion about the lack of support from the United States, the White House, and extolling Peru's cooperation in a regional strategy against drugs and counterinsurgency?
We were very pleased that for the first year of the Bush administration, President Bush was concerned. This is prior to 9/11, and that we give him courage for standing up to Toledo and saying something in Lima. She was the number one item in the agenda when he went down in March. But instead of then having the backbone, as we thought our president would have, when Toledo had an opportunity to be told what to do, the United States backed off and just allowed Lori to be thrown to the wolves of Peru. And I can't take that as a father or as a parent or as an American citizen. It's wrong. President Clinton let Lori stay in jail for 5 years, and then 4 days before he left office on January 16, 2000, he calls the interim Peruvian president and kind of says, why don't you release Lori so I can retire and Lori can come home or something? And the Peruvian president laughed at him. He was a lame duck and said, no, she's getting a trial. And Clinton said, okay, she can have a trial. Now you have no backbone George Bush.
That was Mark Berenson, father of Lori Berenson, who remains in the Huacaris prison in the northern Andes. Contact Lori's supporters by calling area code 202-548-8480 or visit their website at www.freelori.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.